And good evening, everyone. I'm Juliette Papa. Tonight, the leading Democratic candidates for New York City mayor meet in person for the final debate before early voting starts this Saturday. And who are they? Eric Adams, who has been leading in the polls, is now facing a controversy and questions about where he lives. Andrew Yang, whose polling numbers have been dipping, will name recognition be enough to get him through the primary? Catherine Garcia, former sanitation commissioner and recently tapped food czar during the pandemic, has been riding high after New York Times and Daily News endorsements. Don't count out Maya Wiley picking up a major progressive endorsement from New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Current New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer been critical of the de Blasio administration. Sexual harassment allegations have been plaguing his campaign. Stay with us after the debate for analysis with our local experts. Now we turn it over.
Tonight, the race for mayor. The city prepares to choose a new leader. Over the next hour, the five leading Democratic candidates in the party will square off in the final debate before early primary voting begins on Saturday.
Now on CBS 2 and streaming on CBSN New York, New York City Debates, the Democratic primary. Here is your moderator, CBS 2's Maurice Dubois.
And good evening, everyone. It is so good to have you with us. I am joined here in the studio tonight with CBS 2 political reporter Marcia Kramer.
Thank you.
And here with us as well tonight, the candidates, Scott Stringer, Catherine Garcia, Andrew Yang, Maya Wiley, and Eric Adams. Our debate is co-sponsored by News Radio 880, 1010 Winds, and Common Cause New York. And before we begin, a few things to mention. Podium positions have all been selected at random. Each candidate will have 1 minute to respond to our questions. Rebuttal, when necessary, will be 45 seconds. And ladies and gentlemen, please, we're asking you please to respect the time limits. We will turn off the microphones if they're exceeded and if we're forced to. Mr. Yang, we're going to begin with you. This morning, Eric Adams informed us that he had changed his mind about participating in this debate after refusing the invitation earlier in the week. About the same time, a published report came out questioning his residency. Do you believe that Mr. Adams lives in New York City?
I'm glad Eric is here. Thank you on behalf of the voters of New York City, Eric. But I want to reflect, Maurice, on the oddness and the bizarreness of where we are in this race right now, where Eric is literally trying to convince New Yorkers where he lives and that he lives in this basement. And it's troubling because Eric, unfortunately, has not only been not straightforward, but he's been hypocritical. He spent months attacking me for not being a New Yorker. Meanwhile, he was attacking me from New Jersey. He calls himself a reformer, but he's been investigated for corruption at every stage, city, state, even Barack Obama's Federal Department of Justice. And he says he's the blue-collar mayor. Meanwhile, he's a landlord with five units who doesn't report any rental income. So I'm glad you're here to answer some of these questions, Eric. But unfortunately, his tour of the basement raised more questions than it answered for many New Yorkers, including me.
Ms. Wiley, do you believe Mr. Adams lives in the city?
Yeah, I really believe that New Yorkers don't care so much where Mr. Adams lays his head. But it is absolutely clear that New Yorkers want a mayor who is fully forthcoming and fully honest. And I know that with Mr. Adams, there have been issues about his memory, like remembering meeting with donors who, frankly, were engaged in what appears to be a corrupt pay-to-play, and yet couldn't remember when asked by investigators. That there are issues with remembering to, as a landlord, to pay and account for rents in rental property. And of course, there's the question of remembering his position a year ago on Stop and Frisk, where he said it was a great tool that he used often. And the issue is honesty.
Ms. Garcia, do you believe Mr. Adams lives in the city?
I have to say that I'm happy that Eric is here today. I found the article utterly confusing, to be quite honest. I was like, is this a Where's Waldo moment? But I know that the voters care deeply about the issues that are facing this city. They want a mayor who's transparent, who's going to be able to deliver on their affordable housing promises, who's going to be able to deliver on a more equitable city, and who's going to be able to make this someplace where people have real economic opportunity. And I have been the city's go-to crisis manager for the last 14 years, whether or not that was in Hurricane Sandy or during COVID, delivering food to people who were sick or who were homebound. This is a moment where New York City is facing an existential crisis, and that's why the New York Times and the Daily News endorse me, because they know that I'm the person who can deliver on impossible problems.
Mr. Stringer, do you believe Mr. Adams lives in the city?
Well, let me say, first of all, the only time I go to New Jersey is by accident. And I want to invite everybody to my two-bedroom apartment to meet my wife and kids, but you can't look in the refrigerator because you don't want to go there. Look, Eric Adams has made his statement. I don't think this debate should be about where you put your head down at night. I do think that this election is going to determine not just the next 4 years in this city, but the next 25. We need a mayor who is not going to rely on training wheels when they get to City Hall. I'm running for mayor because I believe on day one, I'm ready to tackle affordable housing, to tackle economic justice, to tackle education. I think these are the issues that people want to talk about in this city. When I go out, they don't want to know where people go at the end of the night. They want to know what you do when you get up in the morning, that you're not going to the gym. You're actually going to City Hall. You're actually going to make a difference in this city. And that's why I'm running.
Mr. Adams, your chance to respond. Oh,
thank you. Thank you for that. And you know what? I agree with Scott. Let's be clear. If you're on the ground, you know what people are asking about. I live in Brooklyn. I live in Bedford-Stuyvesant. I am happy to be there. It's a beautiful community. That's where I live. It's a humble place, but it's a blue-collar place. I'm a blue-collar candidate. I live in Brooklyn, New York. I'm proud of that. I served as a police officer in Brooklyn. I became a state senator elected from Brooklyn, and now I am the Brooklyn Borough President. And we can play these silly conversations, but we can do exactly what Scott Stringer stated. I know what people are concerned about on the ground, because I'm on the ground. I don't live in New Paltz. I live in Brooklyn. And I love the place that Tracy and I were able to obtain. I have not seen her in 2 months after Saturday when I went over to see her. But she's sacrificing because she knows how important this is.
Eric, I just want to say, as a candidate, we've been on dozens of forums together, and I've never seen that basement apartment in my life. And I think the other candidates here would agree. But we have seen the New Jersey background, and apparently the doorman in Fort Lee recognized you immediately. When you say, hey, who's this person? They say, Eric Adams, 22H.
May I respond?
15 seconds, and we got to move on.
Yes. I was asked by Mr. Yang to produce my Easy Pass. I did. Then he started to say, produce what milk you have in your fridge, produce what type of vegan cheese you have. This is silly. I live in Bed-Stuy. I'm a Brooklynite, and I'm proud to be a Brooklynite.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move on, Marcia.
Okay, the next question is going to go to Maya Wiley. Ms. Wiley, Attorney General Tish James is proposing legislation to limit cops from firing their weapons, use of force as a last resort. Now, some might ask, why not go all the way and take away the guns altogether like they do in 19 other countries where the bulk of the police force is unarmed?
Well, look, you know, one of the things we have to do is acknowledge that the mayor's job is safety. Safety is job one. And I'm going to keep New Yorkers safe when I'm mayor.
Will you take the guns away from them?
And that does mean that we want smart policing. I think we know that we have a problem with illegal guns coming into this city. We have the strongest gun control laws in the country. The issue is how they're coming in. So we do want a police department that is focused on keeping them out of the city and off our streets.
But will you take the guns away from the NYPD?
I am not prepared to make that decision in a debate. I am going to have a civilian commissioner and a civilian commission that is going to hold the police accountable and make sure we're safe from crime, but also from police violence.
Ms. Garcia.
We have seen a real spike in crime, particularly gun violence, in this city. We have to keep New Yorkers safe, regardless of the color of their skin. And that is why I have a plan to get guns off the street. And I certainly am not
going away from the police.
I'm not going to take guns away from the police. They are confronted with people who are criminals who have guns. And that is why my focus is making sure that we get guns out of the hands of criminals so we don't lose any more children. The last thing any parent wants to find out is that their child has been killed by random gun violence. It's imperative to make sure that we have police focused on this, that we are increasing the size of the gun suppression division, that we have neighborhood policing, and that we do gun buybacks. because when we do this, we make all of our communities safer, and that's imperative for us to rebuild the economy. And I understand how to get this done because I've been a uniform manager. I understand uniform agencies and how to make them work.
Mr. Stringer.
We're not taking guns away from the police. We're going to make sure that we create a police force that focuses on rooting out violent crime and at the same time ensures the civil rights of our young people, especially in our black and brown communities. Let's face it. I'm a kid from Washington Heights. I grew up in the 1970s when there were 2,000 murders a year. I remember when the A train was a rolling crime scene. Mm. We're not going back to that when I'm mayor. But here's what we're going to do. We're not going to think that every solution to criminal justice is a badge and a gun. We've got to invest in helping our kids stay away from the criminal justice and the prisons. And the way to do that is invest in kids with jobs and internships, making sure that they have an opportunity to be the kind of human beings that they want to be, but they don't have economic opportunity. We have to walk and chew gum at the same time. And we need a mayor with real government experience who's not going to back down and transform a public safety plan that's going to make sure our neighborhoods prosper economically through the lens of social justice. And yes, to root out the violence, because we must keep our city safe.
Mr. Adams.
No, I would not. And it's imperative that we have police that are properly trained. Marsha, I'll never forget doing what was called APs at the time, riding the subway from 8 at night to 4 in the morning during those times that Scott Stringer stated. When there was a woman on the train, she had a knife trying to stab someone, swinging wildly. And I had to make a decision. Do I draw my firearm with other passengers on it and strike them? Or do I take actions? And I had to wrestle that knife away from her. So it's not about carrying the gun. It's knowing how to have the proper training that you don't harm innocent people and you don't harm yourself. So, no, I would not. We have an overproliferation of guns in our city. And we must make sure that we decrease the flow of guns in our city and have what I believe a unit that focuses on the illegal guns that are in our city.
Mr. Yan.
Of course not. The police need to be equipped to fight crime in any circumstance. And if anything, we need to go on a massive recruitment drive for new police officers. We're losing about 5,000 officers to retirement. I was in Brownsville the other day and someone said something to me that should be our mission. He said, I would love it if the police officer who's patrolling our neighborhoods from our neighborhood and looked like me. We need a 21st century police force that reflects the incredible diversity of our city. We should be recruiting very aggressively and ambitiously among black and Latino communities, Muslim, Asian, Jewish, women. If we do this, then we can ease the concerns of many New Yorkers, but also help lead to real safety. Because right now, safety is the first step towards any recovery. Every New Yorker I talk to is deeply concerned about the fact that we don't feel safe on our streets, on our subways. We're going to need the police to turn this around. My first act as mayor will be to go to the police and say, we need you. The city needs you. We need you to lead our recovery. We need you to do your jobs professionally, responsibly, and justly. And that's how our recovery will begin.
Marsha, can I get in on this one quickly on Brownsville?
Because 15 seconds. 15
critically
seconds.
Important because we were all in Brownsville for an interview with
seconds.
Primus Interrupters, who said explicitly, not more police officers, more investment in community-based organizations. The safest they ever felt was the 5 days they asked the police department to step back so they could prevent violence.
Your time is up.
Okay. Ms. Garcia, we live in a time when we have New Yorkers just walking down the street getting sucker punched because of their ethnicity. People be getting pushed onto subway tracks. And the case we all saw last weekend, an innocent little boy getting shot and killed because of a dispute between two grown men. How do you change this culture of violence and just straight out ugliness?
We have to protect every New Yorker, regardless of their ethnicity or their religion. We have seen an uptick in anti-Asian hate crime, but we have also seen an uptick in anti-Semitism. It has to stop. We have all been, everyone on this stage, to too many vigils, to too many marches because of this increase in crime. And when I'm mayor, we will keep everyone safe with a multi-pronged approach. We know that there have been real cases of mental illness in these crimes. Police and mental health professionals need to engage up front so we prevent the crime from ever happening, and that we do use Kendra's law to make it so people get the treatment that they need. We have to continue to make investment in mental health services because we know that it works. And for many of these people who are homeless, we know supportive housing works, and getting them housed will help solve the problem. And I know that we can get it built because I've done $8 billion worth of capital construction the city of New York.
Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Mr. Stringer, how do you change this culture of violence and just straight out ugliness?
Look, it starts in the beginning with our children. We have to invest in our kids. The reality is right now, a lot of our children do not have hope because we don't invest in them. A lot of our children don't believe that there's a way out because we don't create opportunities for them to have jobs and real opportunity. A lot of their parents were the frontline workers who suffer from COVID. And the debate always becomes, is it a badge and a gun that's going to solve the problems? Or is it going to be some other checkmark that someone says in the heat of a campaign? I believe we have to have wholesale reform. What I would do as mayor, I'm going to keep the city safe, but I'm going to start with the kids. I'm going to give them opportunity. We're going to make sure that parents have NYC under 3 to triple the number of kids eligible for child care because brain development is 0 to 3. I'm going to make sure that we have 2 teachers in every classroom so kids feel that they're being attended to, not just in the rich schools and the private schools, but in all the schools. And then I'm going to make sure we have after school for every child in the city. You see, when we invest in kids, we keep them away from the criminal justice system. And that's what the next mayor has to do.
Thank you. Mr. Adams.
I just, you know, really want to just reiterate on some of the things that Scott stated. We must have an intervention and prevention. Prevention are the long-term things we must do. Something simple as dyslexia screening. 30% of our prison population is predicted they're dyslexic. So if we want to stop crime, we have to have early childhood intervention. It's imperative that we do so to prevent it. We need to look and lean into the foster care system. The number of our babies in foster care that age out with no support at all, it is feeding our criminal justice system. And we don't seem to care. 600 to 700 foster cares age out every year. So we want to really change the ecosystem of public safety, finally define what's the role of police in that ecosystem, and look at the roles of others. Crisis management team, those who are good at dealing with retaliatory shootings. We can turn this around, but it can't be just police.
Can I just jump in here for one moment, Mr. Yang is next, please.
I just want to dig into the specific cases you cited, Maurice. The man who shot Justin Wallace has been apprehended. The man who shoved the Asian gentleman onto the subway tracks is still at large. And Alex Wright was the person who punched the Chinese woman in downtown Manhattan and was apprehended. But Alex Wright is the story we have to dig into, because Alex Wright was arrested 8 times in the prior 12 months for, among other things, throwing hot coffee on a traffic agent, throwing an object through a window, scratching a man in the eye on the Upper East Side, punching another person, and he was walking our streets. When we talk about how to keep New Yorkers safe, what about the families who are walking around who don't want to be assaulted by Alex Wright, who was arrested multiple times in the prior year? We have to examine every step of the process that allowed Alex Wright to be on our streets, whether it's police, the district attorney, the bail laws, the mental health, Kendra's Law rules where you can hold someone who's mentally ill. But the fact is, New Yorkers deserve to be safe on our own streets. We have to get people who need help the help that they need, regardless of whether they have the capacity to raise their hands and seek it.
Thank you. Ms. Wiley.
Look, you know, let's be very clear, because Justin Wallace is not dead because we don't have enough police officers. He is dead because we have never in this city done the very thing that communities like in the Far Rockaways or Washington Heights or Mott Haven have been asking us for, which is trauma-informed care in our schools, which is in my plan, but also even yesterday when we were at the vigil for Justin with his community there and all the various crisis management groups, those people were talking about the fact that they are not paid for all the hours they put in. They have a catchment area with a place that they can't, not supposed to cross. They do those services anyway, but they don't do it with social workers on their staff. They don't do it with mental health experts. I'm going to change that because that's going to keep people safe.
Thank you. Ms. Garcia, you had a rebuttal.
No, it was not really a rebuttal. It's just I wanted to actually reiterate what Eric was saying, particularly about foster care, because that's very personal to me. You know, I was adopted and two of my siblings were adopted, one of whom spent 7 years in the foster care system. If we don't make investments in forever families and making sure that they have coaches, it is likely that they will be 50% more likely to be involved in the criminal justice
system. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Garcia.
15 seconds.
So our next question is going to come from one of our radio partners. So here is Julia Papa from 1010 Winds.
Historically, New York City mayors and governors have not gotten along. Mario Cuomo and Ed Koch despised each other. And the bad blood between Bill de Blasio and Andrew Cuomo is legendary. Since Mr. Cuomo is a notorious micromanager, if you get elected, what will you do to ensure that you have a good working relationship with him?
Mr. Stringer, you get the first chance to answer the question.
Well, look, this is where experience comes in. Mayor de Blasio played checkers with Andrew Cuomo when he should have been playing chess. And the reality is we need to reset the Albany relationship between the mayor and the governor. I've been one of the leading reformers when I served in the state assembly. I was independent, but I was also effective. Nobody in Albany, when I'm mayor, is going to steal my lunch money. I'm going to go to Albany. I'm going to work with the Senate and the Assembly. We're going to craft policies. We're going to make sure that the legislature and the governor do what's right by the people of the city. We've seen that we've made gains in the last legislative session, in part because of the Democrats in the state Senate. We've seen more foundation aid come to the city. We've seen more economic opportunity for the city. But we need a mayor who's going to lead in the halls of Albany. I've done that for 13 years. I know the players. I also have the strategy to get that done. This is where training wheels end up derailing the city.
Mr. Adams.
Well, I get along with everyone. All of my candidates, they love me. And so I think that that's the joy of who I am. But, you know, seriously speaking, you know, I always equate my life back to those 22 years being on the ground. And if we were responding to an assault in progress or domestic violence, while I'm running into that building with my partner, I'm not fighting with him or her on my way up those steps.
How are you going to get along with the governor?
We're going to touch on that. And so I saw during COVID-19, when people were dropping their family members off to hospitals, never to see them again, I saw people unsure about their housing, their food. And instead of the governor and the mayor coming together doing joint press conferences, saying that we got this, New York, we saw just the opposite. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to put my ego to the side, and I'm going to sit down and work a relationship with the governor and say, we're Team New York, and we're not going to have public disputes. We're going to solve our problems.
Thank you very much, Mr. Adams. Mr. Yang.
The job of the mayor of New York City is to deliver for the people of New York City. And you cannot do that if you don't have a collaborative, productive relationship with the governor and Albany. I've had a number of calls with Governor Cuomo. I worked with his brother at CNN. I can work with Governor Cuomo, but I can work with anyone who's going to help us deliver for the people of New York. And we have seen what happens in the city when this relationship is completely broken. You will never see me scoring cheap political points on Tuesday and then be less able to deliver for you and your families on Wednesday. I'm so thrilled to have been endorsed already by state legislators, not just here in New York City, but around the state. And the truth is, our interests are the same because the state's recovery relies upon New York City's recovery. We're the majority of the economic output in this state, and I'm going to be able to build the right relationships to deliver for us, the families of New York City.
Ms. Wiley.
Well, you know, having served in the senior cabinet of City Hall, I've actually done this on women and minority-owned business enterprises, where I walked in and was handed a program with no staff or resources, that $500 million in contracts we needed in part to get a change in state legislation. So I had a conversation with our counterparts inside the governor's office. We also organized and worked with the state representatives from New York City and the women and minority-owned business enterprises that wanted the legislation.
But how do you get along with the governor?
This is extremely important because what's critical to getting along with the governor is making sure we're organizing the constituents that he serves along with the mayor of New York City. That's how I got the legislation passed, ultimately with those partnerships. And I'm very proud to have been endorsed by so many of our state senators and assembly members because they know I can get it done.
Ms. Garcia.
We all saw how the toxic relationship between the governor and the mayor hurt us during the height of the pandemic. I'm just going to start with the fact that I'm very happy to be on this stage with another strong woman leader, and that women leadership matters. We haven't gotten to 50% here, Maya, but, you know, we're working hard to get there. And I have worked very successfully with people at the state level, particularly with the Department of Environmental Conservation. And it's not just about the governor. It is also about our senators and our assembly. We have to be working together because I know that there's so much need in New York, and New Yorkers don't care who's in charge of the MTA. They just want to get to work on time. And I'm going to make it my job to ensure that that is what the outcome is, because at the end of the day, the fights between a mayor and the governor hurt New Yorkers, and my job is to make it so that they are successful so that we deliver a more livable city for all New Yorkers.
15 seconds, Mr. Stringer.
I just want to, I guess, say to Andrew, your approach is naive. This is not how Albany works. Albany will go after you. Albany will collapse you if you don't understand that the forces around the state do not want us to get the funding that we deserve. We have been defunded in every step of the way. Okay. It is not enough to say we're all going to be friends, kumbaya. We need a mayor with experience who knows the legislative process.
Thank you. Just a quick response.
The state needs the city, Scott. The city needs the state. The two do go hand in hand. And it's easier to work with someone who, again, isn't trying to score political points, who just wants to get the job done. That's the kind of leadership that the city has been waiting for quite some time.
Okay, this is de Blasio 2.0, my friend.
We're going to move on.
De Blasio is the opposite of what I just described.
No, that's not true.
Thank you both. We're going to move on. Another question here from one of our partners. This is Linda Lopez from News Radio 880.
With marijuana laws changing in New York, would you consider regulations for public places in the city, including apartment buildings, to shield non-using adults and children from secondhand smoke and exposure?
Mr. Adams, smoke wafting through the air.
Yes. You know, I'm concerned that even as a child, my dad smoked often. And little did we know the impact of secondhand smoke. And I'm concerned about the marijuana laws altogether. We have to be very clear that these laws can impact on your behavior. And so we should not encourage young people to smoke marijuana on their way to school. We don't want young people who are performing surgery to have a joint before that surgery. So it's imperative we lay out very clear understandings that this can impact on how you respond. It can impair your judgment. And so when we talk about legalizing here and how it's going to be rolled out in the city, we need to have clear instructions on how to do it correctly.
But I am concerned about secondhand smoke. What about that?
I said, yes, I am. I am in full support that we should make sure we regulate where the smoking is taking place, particularly in apartment buildings where people live.
Okay, Mr. Yang.
I am thrilled that New York State is legalizing marijuana, but we do need to be mindful of the effects of secondhand smoke, particularly on families. I am a parent. I've got two young boys who are 8 and 5. So we should designate particular areas, particularly in large apartment buildings, that are appropriate for smoking marijuana and not. And families should not be in position where they're concerned about the impact of secondhand smoke if they're just walking in their own apartment building, taking their kid to school.
Ms. Wiley.
There is absolutely no reason to treat smoking a marijuana cigarette differently from smoking a regular cigarette, which means in the places where we're protecting public health from secondhand smoking, we will continue to do that. That's actually the way the law will work. But I think it's really important to understand it is critically important that we legalized it, because what it was doing to not be legal was simply to ensure that young black and brown kids were getting thrown into prison when, frankly, white kids in different zip codes were doing the same thing and not getting arrested. We have to protect public health. We will. But it's just like alcohol as well. We will regulate it in terms of workplace safety as
well. What about apartment buildings? Comes through the door, through the wall?
Same thing we do with cigarettes. There's really no reason to distinguish between a cigarette that is a marijuana cigarette and a cigarette that is not a marijuana cigarette.
Thank you. Ms. Garcia.
I completely agree with Maya on this. We need to treat them as we would treat regular cigarettes. I think that they're not totally illegal in all apartment buildings, though. And we need to protect everyone from secondhand smoke. You know, we saw during COVID that having an underlying lung condition made you incredibly vulnerable to dying. I am pleased that we have legalized marijuana because it did fall far too harshly on our black and brown communities. And, you know, my brother is African American, and I know that he saw this happen in his communities. I know this is personal to me. We saw over-policing because of it. But I also want to see us invest the money that we raise from the taxes on marijuana in exactly those zip codes where we had significant arrests. And I know that we can get this done because I have been serving the city for the last 14 years.
Thank you. Mr. Stringer.
Well, I agree with Maya and Catherine. I do think we have to make sure that secondhand smoke is dealt with just like cigarettes. But I think we do raise some issues about cannabis equity. It's not just enough to legalize marijuana and then talk about the economic benefit to the state and to the city, which is, I think, $400 million to the state, $335 million to the city. The question is, who's going to be selling cannabis and who's going to profit from it? And as others have pointed out, in communities of color over many decades with the Rockefeller drug laws, people went to jail based on their skin color and the community that they lived in for marijuana. We have to go back into those communities and talk to the children who lost their moms and dads and give them the opportunity for licensing and job opportunity, because this is going to be a big business. And we have to make sure that the people we invest with are the people who've been harmed in communities. And a mayor will play a role in identifying those areas, working with the legislature.
Thank you.
May I have 15 seconds to just respond?
Please.
It's clear we need to look at the layers, not only those who were negatively impacted. We need to look at credit recovery, credit scores. We need to make sure we have vocational training. We need to use the dollars to make people whole.
Thank you.
Mr. Stringer, the next question's for you. One of your accusers says that years ago you took her bar to bar and groped her when she was 18. Another accuser says you were drinking when you groped her without her permission. You yourself told the New York Times that in that period in the 90s was, quote, a bit of a mess for you. What exactly did that mean? And if the allegations are true, should you be held accountable for your actions?
Well, the allegations are not true. And they're allegations that go back 20 and 30 years. I've done my best to answer every question. I'll continue to do it tonight. But I'm glad you brought up the mess part, because I was misquoted and then requoted accurately. The mess I was talking about was the bar business, not in any way diminishing.
But it seems like you were going from bar to bar and there was drinking involved. And the question is, did that impair your ability?
30 years ago, I cannot tell you exactly where those allegations come from. But I can tell you, and I mean this, if there's in any way I've made anyone in my entire life uncomfortable, I certainly apologize for that. But that quote was a misquote, and it was unfortunate that the quote wasn't right.
But should you be held accountable for those actions?
I want to be held accountable to anyone who wishes, the press or otherwise, to investigate what took place 30 years ago and 20 years ago. Unfortunately, in the middle of a campaign, it has been a struggle to find a way to communicate that. Now it's up to the voters to look at my 30-year record of service, personal history, and make a decision as to who's best qualified for mayor. And I think New Yorkers will know my record and where I stand.
I just want to just one quick thing, really important for the viewing audience to understand. It is not just about discomfort. That is not what we're hearing. But also, it takes two to view any sexual conduct as welcome.
Okay,
I agree with you, Maya.
On to Mr. Yang here. If you're elected mayor, would you have your police detail drive you to your country home up in New Paltz? Would taxpayer dollars be spent to feed and house your police detail while you're in the country? Who would pay for gas and tolls?
New York City is in crisis mode. I don't expect to leave the city a single day for my first term. I'm going to be here grinding it out because that's what our city requires right now. We all can look around us and see how badly wounded New York is. Families don't feel safe on our streets or our subways. Trash is piling up. Our schools are barely open. Half our kids are still not back. So this is going to be the work of a lifetime in many ways, and maybe the last job I do. I had a voter come up to me and say to me, Andrew, I want to vote for you, but can you tell me that you're going to be here 7 days a week, 24 hours a day? Because I like you, but I'm concerned about that. And I said 100%, because this city is going to need me grinding away, just like so many families have been grinding away over these last number of months. New Yorkers are going to be sick of me. They'll be like, Yang, go away, because I'm going to be here all the time, just trying to solve problems and get our city working again for us and our families.
Okay, thank you.
May I 50
Ms. Wiley,
seconds?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Wiley.
Okay.
When you were Mayor de Blasio's top attorney, you devised a way for the mayor to hide potential conflicts of interest with outside consultants, three of whom had business with the city. You called them agents of the city to keep it from the public. Is this a sign of things to come in a Wiley administration?
Thank you for asking that question. You know, I left the administration 5 years ago, and one of the things that I have done as a candidate is made very clear that when I am mayor, first of all, no one is going to have to ask me to disclose any communications with a donor who wants to talk about city business. And secondly, I am not going to have any revolving door for anyone in my administration to lobby the administration as long as I am in office. And thirdly, and this is the most important thing, is we have to establish trust in government. And I'm going to do just that by being transparent and by partnering with the people of the city of New York.
Do you regret establishing agents of the city?
Look, it's very simple that all I did was give the advice that one gives a client and the client makes a decision. And when I am mayor, there's only going to be one decision, which is why it's in my ethics plan.
Mr. Adams had a comment a second ago.
It was indicated that people say would you stay and grind, which people say I do all the time. No one have ever asked me that. They stated that during our most difficult days, you were here 7 days a week and you grind for us, and they will never forget that.
Okay. Mr. Stringer, please.
I just want to say to Maya, you were front and center in two corruption scandals at City Hall. You coined the term agents of the city. You allowed unfettered access to lobbyists and consultants. And then there was the whole issue of the investigation of the pay to play.
So
I do think, if I can say,
yes, please,
that we do need an ethics czar in the city. I've proposed that. And I also think when it comes to foils, when you didn't disclose them, I do believe now the Department of Investigation should have authority on mayoral foils, because the redaction and the cover up was probably worse than the potential crime.
So thank you for raising that, because I think we completely agree about corruption, and which is exactly why the DOI said explicitly that it was clear that the mayor did not always listen to his counsel in their investigation report. But here's the thing. Scott Stringer, you have been the person who has actually used your public office to do audit reports against Catherine Garcia. That really started after it was in your personal interests. And one thing I have never been accused of or done is use any position, whether counsel to the mayor or chairing the New York City Civilian Complaint Review Board, to use any public resources to essentially advance my personal interests.
Can I just, Maya, can I respond here? Yeah, quick response. First of all, that audit was initiated in July of 2020 before Catherine thought about running for mayor. It's actually what controllers do. And the next mayor is going to have to deal with a controller, hopefully as aggressive as me. While you were dealing with City Hall and agents of the city, I was investigating the Rivington deal. We exposed what was happening at DCAS. Right. And I just think we should be honest about this.
Thank you.
Yes, I think it's clear we don't need another politician. We need somebody who actually is willing to get the work. And I want to thank Maya for standing up and pointing out that if you started the audit in July and you just released it now, there's no politics involved.
No, because audits take 12 months to 14 months. And if I didn't release it, you would be saying I was covering up something.
You know that I fired that vendor well before that audit was complete, because I was doing what no one else on this stage was doing, which is delivering for New Yorkers during the height of COVID. Whether or not that was making sure we were actually picking up the garbage with 20% of the force out sick, or putting together a food program that, as of now, has delivered 230 million meals.
You're going to get audited.
Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Speaking of controllers and audits, what's your response to a state controller audit last fall that the sanitation department, under your direction, your leadership, did not keep the streets sufficiently clean and used outdated record-keeping systems? The staff sampled 271 city blocks, and they found 189 streets were dirty based on city metrics. What's your response to that?
As I said at the time, and as I have said consistently, the Department of Sanitation has made the city cleaner under my watch based on the data that we have, that we are audited not by the controller, but by another mayor's office every single month. And we worked really hard and added new protocols.
But what about this particular report?
And in that particular report, I specifically said that there were things that we needed to continue to evolve, but that we saw litter as something that's a day-to-day issue. When you take away alternate side of the street parking, you impact city residents. And when I left city government, when we lost the $100 million, you saw the impact. And when I'm mayor, I'm never going to sacrifice cleanliness, because particularly in a pandemic, cleanliness is really incredibly important.
Thank you.
The next question goes to Eric Adams. Mr. Adams, you claim that you would be the best candidate to reduce gun violence in New York City, but the police precincts in northern Brooklyn have some of the highest gun crimes in the entire city. Why haven't you been able to reduce crime in your own backyard?
A great question, because when you look at gun violence, we often look at the act that triggered was actually pulled and not what led up to the climate that created that. I remember an 11-year-old child being arrested for robbery when I was a lieutenant. And when I spoke with him, you know what I found out, Marsha? I found out he was raising himself. His mother was on crack. His dad was in jail. He had no one at home. We allow these babies to slip through the cracks. And if you go to these areas where violence is high, you know what you're going to find? You're going to find proficiency rates are low. You're going to find a high level of foster care. You're going to find a high level of drug abuse. So we need to deal with gun violence holistically and deal with it immediately.
But people are going to look at you and they're going to say, how can you make us feel safe if you couldn't stop it in your own backyard?
I don't concur with that. The mayor of the city of New York controls his police department. I introduced what was called SNUG, guns spelled backwards. This was a program that dealt with having crisis management teams when I was in the state senate. And everyone knows the role that these crisis management teams are playing. When you put in a real comprehensive plan to deal with violence, you can bring down violence. I had several conversations with the mayor of initiatives that I would introduce, but I'm not the mayor yet. On January 1st, you're going to see some amazing initiatives.
I want to speak to this because Eric's campaign seems to go like this. You're concerned about crime. I used to be a cop 20 years ago. I should be mayor. But the fact is, when Eric talked to some audiences, he said the cops love him. And then to other audiences, the cops can't stand him. He goes to one audience and says, Mayor Giuliani, great on crime. And then he turns to another audience and says, Mayor Dinkins, great on crime. So it's unclear exactly what Eric's approach to our safety would be. And this is his core issue. And like you just said, Marsha, shootings are up over 100% in Brooklyn, his borough. The solve rate, the clearance rate for those shootings, 25%. 3 out of 4 shooters are still walking around.
May I respond?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Let's be clear. I don't know where Andrew has been until a shooting happened down the block from his house. No one can question my commitment around ending violence in this city. No one on the stage can tell you that they have put their life on the line to save New Yorkers. No one else can do that. I can say that. And I have put in place real programs and plans to deal with violence in the city. He was not there. You never have to ask, where was I?
Okay, we're going to move on. This question is for everyone. We're going to start with Mr. Springer. Stringer, excuse me. Many people are surprised to learn a number of iconic places in our city are named after individuals who held people as slaves. Names like Stuyvesant, Nostrand, Lefferts, and Borum. Should New Yorkers have to live on streets or go to schools or buildings named for slaveholders, or should those names be changed?
I believe the names have to be changed in a thoughtful, community-led process. Because the truth is, one of the things that we have to recognize is that we're not talking about history with us adults. We're actually building history for the next generation of New Yorkers. And I want my children, my two little kids, to have a sense of the true history of the city and not to think that these people were somehow generationally praised, but in reality, they did some of the worst things to other human beings. I think it's inappropriate for the city and the mayor to lead that conversation. And I believe as mayor, I would do that immediately. Progress has been made, the discussion's there, and I will continue to initiate that.
Mr. Adams.
Yes, change the names. If anyone that has a terrible history, we should change the name. When I was endorsed by Salamanca in the Bronx, I did it in front of Spofford, a place that I served as a child in Spofford juvenile facilities. But a large number of my childhood friends went to Rikers. Rikers is named after someone that has a terrible record. So we need to look at all the schools, all the streets. We need to redo our history in the right way. We should not honor people that have had an abusive past. I say, yes, let's change those names.
Mr. Yang.
Times change. We should listen to the will of New Yorkers as to who they want the streets named after, who they want schools named after. I would be open to changing the names. And certainly if someone was a slaveholder and had a legacy of racism and slavery, then those names should be changed.
Ms. Wiley.
You know, look, I'm the child of civil rights activists, went to law school to be a civil rights lawyer, worked at the ACLU, NAACP Legal Defense Fund, founded an organization that I ran for a dozen years to transform structural racism. We have to change these names, but we have to do more. We actually have to make sure that in a crisis like this, we're not only doing things that are symbolic, although symbols matter. We have to actually make sure all of our communities of color that are represented in people who have been harmed by this history also finally get the attention, the investments, and the change that they deserve, whether it's Southeast Brooklyn or Southeast Queens. I'll get that done.
Ms. Garcia.
Absolutely. We need to make it so that we are changing these names. But we also need to make sure that we are teaching our own history. When we celebrate these people, it means that we're not actually telling anyone the rest of what was happening. So, yes, we should change these names, but we also should be very transparent about what actually occurred in New York City, both the good and the bad.
So the next question goes to you, Mr. Yang. There are more bicycles on the streets of New York City than ever before. Some of them are motorized, reaching speeds of up to 30 miles an hour, and injuries have resulted. What do you think about requiring license plates on bikes so people who violate the rules and the rules of the road can be ticketed?
I'm an avid bicyclist. One of the joys of the last number of years was bringing my kids to school on the back of the bike before they outgrew it. It was a sad day. But you're right, Marcia, that there are a lot of e-bikes out there and scooters, and our infrastructure is really not set up for it. So we do need to make sure that people aren't traveling at speeds that are going to be dangerous for families that are crossing the crosswalk. I do think we should certainly be licensing e-bikes and any vehicle that can go above a certain speed. And I want to speak to something that a lot of New Yorkers are suffering from, which is noise pollution from certain types of ATVs and bikes that are designed just for maximal volume. Like, that is illegal. We need to enforce that and make sure that we're not terrorized on our own streets. I've been walking down the street with my family, and then all of a sudden there's just like, and then you're just like, what is going on?
But Mr.
Like,
Yang, what about the bicycle riders who, what about the bicycle riders who disobey the law? They don't go in the bike lanes. They go up the wrong street the wrong way. They go up the middle of the street. Shouldn't there be license plates so you can ticket them?
I've actually, I don't know if this is going to be bad news, but I've actually received a ticket on a bicycle, and the lack of a plate on the back of it did not seem to to keep this officer from issuing me a ticket. So as far as I can tell, we can already issue a cyclist a ticket if they're doing something inappropriate. And in my case, I didn't even realize that I wasn't in a bike lane at the time, and got the ticket.
Thank you,
and paid
Mr.
it.
Mr. Yang. Ms. Wiley, should there be license plates on bikes?
Look, I think we have to make sure that our transportation system is faster, cheaper, and safer. That does include how we are addressing bikes and particularly motorized scooters and bikes. But look, the real issue here is that we have to do a better job of how we're rebuilding this city and remaking it so that we can have more transportation alternatives that happen safely.
Should there be license plates?
I think that the issue is not license plates. The issue is making sure that we're creating more protected bike lanes, that we're creating a better culture around how we're inculturating the practices. I have in my plan creating an Office of Open Space Management, de-siloing government to do just that.
Ms. Garcia.
We have seen actual incredible usage of bikes during the pandemic. It's the only part of our public transportation system that grew. But we are a really dense city. So for anything that is motorized, bike, scooter, skateboard, whatever they're motorizing, those need to have licenses.
What about
but
regular
for
bikes?
A regular bicycle, you need to follow the rules, but you will be pulled over if you don't. But a license seems a barrier to what we want people to do, because biking is the cleanest form of transportation. And I am supportive. I'm going to do 250 miles of bike lanes. And that's why I got endorsed by the Streets Pack, because they know I will actually get it done.
Mr. Stringer.
Don't license the bikes, in part because I want to make sure that we give high school students a free bike so they can get to school in a protective bike lane that I'll initiate when I'm mayor. I have every intention of being the street mayor. That just doesn't just include bikes. It includes 35 miles a year of busways, dedicated walkways. We have to reimagine our streets, not just through the lens of open streets, which I support, but we really have an opportunity to change the transportation culture in the city. That's going to help low-wage workers. That's going to bring our city back to life. But I don't think a licensing bureaucracy will do us well, especially for kids who will get caught up with policing and over-policing.
Mr. Adams.
No, I wouldn't license bikes. It's, as a kid, I had to put my bikes together from spare parts. And, you know, young people, particularly in the inner city, they don't have the money to go down to license registration. That opens the door for more unnecessary police interactions. Mm-hmm. But we should comply with the rules, and we should do it on an educational level. I believe under Eric Adams' administration, 3 days a week, children would ride to and from their school by having safe corridors, because we solve multiple problems. We deal with childhood obesity, exercise, and also we can collaborate with each other in doing so. So I don't believe in licensing, but I do believe we need to comply with the rules in the process.
This next question, we're going to need brief answers, like 15 seconds as we get near the end of the hour here. Ms. Wiley, we're going to start with you. One of the biggest problems with the pandemic is getting people to get back to workplaces in Manhattan. Do you think enacting congestion pricing and charging more to get into Midtown is a good idea right now? Should it be postponed until the city recovers? What do you think?
It should be right now, because part of what we need to do with that money is put it into our subway systems to make sure that they're continuing to run and operate, and we have to improve them. But we should also make sure we're taking care of our taxi drivers. You know, we have taxi drivers in the city committing suicide, too high loans. I'm going to make sure that we're bailing out the taxi drivers and not the lenders.
Thank you. Ms. Garcia.
Yes, we need to have congestion pricing put in place.
Now?
Now. We are not suffering from a lack of cars in Midtown today, yesterday, the day before. People are coming in, and if they all come in by car, we can't move. We need people to get back on the subway.
Thank you. Mr. Stringer.
We need congestion pricing. We need it now. The Trump administration thwarted us. We can really build back our transportation system with that revenue.
Mr. Adams.
Need it now. Also, we lockbox, all the money goes into transit. Commissioners and others with cars on the subway system, MetroCard, I use the subway all the time. I think it's important to do it right now. But also, people are not coming to work because it's unsafe. Public safety is a prerequisite to prosperity.
Thank you. Mr. Yang.
Congestion pricing has been a long time in coming, but we have to be mindful of our city's recovery. Right now, 80% of Midtown commercial real estate buildings are still empty. So we have to accelerate the recovery by any means necessary. So I'd be flexible on the timing of adopting congestion pricing in line with the city's return of commuters.
Okay, thank you. We just have a couple minutes left. We want to wrap things up on slightly lighter note here. Please answer the following questions with just one word. I know you can do it. If you had a choice between two superpowers, the ability to fly or be invisible, which would you choose? Mr. Stringer.
Fly.
Ms. Garcia.
Fly.
Mr. Yang.
I literally dream of flying. I've never dreamt of being invisible.
That was more than one word. Ms. Wiley.
Fly.
Fly.
Mr. Adams.
So, Mr. Adams, mayors have landmarks named after them by their successors. In one word, if you were the mayor, what would you be naming for Mayor Giuliani?
Rikers Island.
Ms. Wiley.
Do we have a dump we can out of
No, we do not.
I know. I'm just saying I'd find the dirtiest thing.
So your one word is a dump?
A dump.
Mr. Yang.
An anchor at the bottom of the sea.
Ms. Garcia.
A sewage plant.
And Mr. Stringer.
Affordable housing development, formerly Trump Tower. We could call it Giuliani Way.
No. Mr. Yang, what is the last gift you gave to someone? One word.
I brought home some cannolis for my kids, from Staten Island.
Ms. Wiley.
I paid for the mental health services of someone who needed them.
Mr. Adams.
A pair of sneakers to a homeless man.
Mr. Stringer.
I was in Borough Park and I brought home Shabbos flowers for my amazing wife, 12 dozen roses.
Ms. Garcia.
I got my daughter her ticket for her post-graduation trip.
Oh.
So, Ms. Garcia, what's the one thing you can't live without?
I cannot live without, I've been living without it. I'd really like a mani-pedi.
Okay, Mr. Yang.
My wife, Evelyn.
Ms. Wiley.
Well, my kids and my cats.
Mr. Adams.
Hot bubble baths with warm roses sitting inside. Men like that too.
And Mr. Stringer, the one thing that you can't live without.
I need coffee in the morning, but it's got to be with sweet and low.
All right.
And you brought it with you?
I keep it in my wallet in case I can't find it.
In the wallet. Ms. Wiley, describe yourself in one word.
Silly.
Last question.
Mr. Adams.
Workaholic.
Mr. Stringer. One word.
Come back, kid.
It's worth it.
Ms. Garcia.
Fixer.
Mr. Yang.
Determined.
Determined. I think we're going to leave it right there.
I think we are.
I think we are. We're going to thank you all so much tonight for a civil and civilized and spirited debate. We want to thank you all for being here tonight, along with our partners tonight. News Radio 880, 1010 Wins, The Good Government Group, Common Cause. A reminder, early voting in the New York primary election begins this Saturday. That's June 12th. It runs through Sunday, June 20th. Election day itself is Tuesday, June 22nd. Poll hours are 6 in the morning through 9 p.m. For more information about the election, polling sites, absentee ballots, go to cbsnewyork.com. We've set up some links for you. We thank you all for being with us tonight. For Marcia Kramer, all of us here at CBS2, I'm Maurice Dubois. We'll see you on the news tonight at 11 o'clock. Have a good night, everyone. Thank you.